All right, Purcell, welcome to the show.
Oh, man, thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure. I love doing research on you because there's so much to do. I felt like this was like, I'm like, all right, which branch of Purcell Duggar's life am I going to research over the next half an hour? Because then I got to move on to the next branch of Purcell Duggar's life, which brings forth like the obvious first question. When you introduce yourself to somebody new, what do you say you do for a living, and how long is that conversation before they even get a second question in? Because it feels like you are doing a lot.
I mean, that's a great question. I keep it pretty simple. I am a strength coach, a running coach. But I'm not doing that. I am a marketer. It's pretty simple to me, I think. What those things are informed by, how, you know, I've been attached to my practice as a coach, is very much, you know, that's like a very vertically integrated, lengthy conversation. But in terms of like who I am, what I do, I'm a coach and I'm a marketer. And I would say that first and foremost, before any of that, like I'm a coach and I've been coaching since I don't know when. I have put a date on it, but if I think back to the days I was volunteering as a coach, back when, as early as I was when I was in high school, to when I was in college and I was volunteering as a coach, to when I got my first job out of college, and while I was in college, volunteering at my old high school for cross country as well as for football and basketball. Like I was, coaching has just been a part of my identity since I had one. And I don't know that ever ends. It's gonna evolve and look different as I age, but ultimately like me coaching and me being outside somewhere with a stopwatch and a whistle in my hand, yelling at somebody to, you know, drive their knees up and pump their arms is just part of my identity and my understanding of not just like myself, but even as like movement as a whole. So I've been coaching since coaching, even though I'm like what you would consider like young, in terms of like, you know, ages and like years, not spent coaching, but just rather in terms of, you know, overall compared to like my peers and other folks in the space. But I'm a coach, I'm a marketer, and I'm super, super passionate about the idea of supporting people, you know, in their movement practice through running, you know, working out, lifting. And I've, of course, just always interested and intrigued by the idea of like storytelling from like a marketing perspective.
And it also seems like you're quite a community builder as well. And that seems to be a plank in some of the other things you're doing in addition to that.
Yeah, I mean, even that I consider coaching, right? Because I feel like, you know, we had an event last night and, you know, I'm in the room and I'm listening, I'm taking notes and I'm giving feedback and I'm, you know, talking to people about it. And it's like, I think coaching for me is my mom's a pastor. My dad is a social worker. The two of them have their own unique, I would say like wellness practice and relationship to wellness and what it looks like to care for yourself and care for others. I think my lens is very much coaching. But it's influenced by the two of them in a very like real and macro way. But yeah, community health equity. You know, when you're a kid, you don't name these things. This is just like lived experiences. I think I've grown in both my understanding of health equity and community health, and also in my practice and my contribution to the space, I've recognized that like it's definitely a thing. But I think, you know, I recognize that like that's work. Like that's it's not just a passion. It's not just a hobby. It's not just something that I experience or I'm an enthusiast about, but very much like a live day-to-day craft that I have, it's informed and executed through the lens of marketing and storytelling, because I think that from a change perspective, that one of the best ways that we can impact and drive change and help people to further their relationship with insert thing is through the lens of storytelling and language and how we understand things through the lens of content, through the lens of, you know, events, strategy, et cetera.
Absolutely. We'll get into the nitty gritty of your coaching career and the people you work with and just considerations and questions that apply to a lot of coaches and also how best to work with clients. At the same time, I want to dive into more of the history side first, just kind of going back to you knowing pretty early on that you wanted to help people in terms of their athletic journey. when did it change for you in terms of focusing on your own athletic journey to all of a sudden branching out to be like, okay, I also want to help other people as they go through theirs? And obviously those can happen, you know, concurrently. It doesn't have to be in either or situation.
Yeah, I remember when I was in, it's my first time ever coaching. I was just a volunteer. I would say as a kid, like I was in high school and I was coaching elementary school basketball. Like I was born and raised in Coney Island, Brooklyn, which has a reputation for producing, you know, basketball players at all different levels, but certainly at the professional, at the highest level, but also like collegiate, high school. Like there's just a bunch of quality athletes that have come out of my neighborhood. As I've grown, you know, when I was in college, I would come home over the summer. I would come home for spring break, and I wasn't the kid who would like go party and like Tulum or go to Costa Rica or go to Cozumel or something like that. Like for me, it was like, oh, I'll go home and I'll coach. And I would do that regularly. And when I didn't do it, the one summer I didn't do it, I felt really guilty. I mean, I had a blast in Toronto, but I felt really guilty about it. But my high school, Fort Hamilton High School in Brooklyn, you know, the football team and the cross country team, track and field team always needed support. And I was very much connected to like the legacy and the story that my, and the experiences that, you know, my high school gave me. So for me, it just made sense to always go back there. That was like option one. Like I didn't have to ask. I was asked to, but I didn't have to ask for permission to coach. It was kind of like I showed up and they knew what I was there to do. And I was always welcome with open arms. So I think that curiosity and that level of connection to the sport really just has flourished in like my more recent years. I think it's a little bit different now, having worked at the collegiate level and also worked like with just professional athletes. It looks different. Everyday working professionals, for that matter, it looks different. You don't obviously engage with a kid the same way you engage with a collegiate athlete, the same way you can engage with an adult, the same way you would engage with, you know, a mom or a dad at three or a person who has like some kids. I think it's really important to just be aware of who you're coaching and your audience and what their goals are. But yeah, it started at a very, very young age. I've been passionate about the idea of supporting people in their like performance goals, but also I think in my more recent years, recognizing that it's really important to like identify the person who's committed to these goals and understand them. And then as I understand them more and they understand me more and we build that trust, then leaning into that to extrapolate like the best out of them in the ways that they might not be able to tangibly see at a moment. So yeah, I've been committed to that. Dang, I want to say probably like since 16, but I would say officially coaching in like a very real, like I was being paid to be there as a job. I want to say, yeah, like since I was like 23, 22.
And growing up in the Coney Island area, you have such luminaries that come out of there, at least from a basketball perspective, of Stephon Marbury, Sebastian Telfair, Lance Stephenson, amongst so many others. What pushed you, and you mentioned basketball before a little bit, but you also have now focused much more on the running side, and you went back to help out with running as well. What pushed you to the running side of things as a youngster?
My, believe it or not, my rest in peace, his name is Ruben Sanchez. He was a father figure, a mentor. He was my first coach. And he, in his mind, he felt like if these young kids were unattended, they were going to get in trouble. So we did not have an off season. It was the Coney Island Sharks, but we were not limited to a sport. We did everything. We ran cross country. We ran track. We did hockey. We did volleyball, baseball. We played football, basketball. Like there was several times throughout the summer, we were playing multiple sports at multiple different, at the simultaneously. And it was a great time. And for me, it was something that was normalized. Like it wasn't as though I only ran or I only played basketball. It wasn't until maybe I say I got to high school where people started to say, hey, you can only do, gotta pick one, gotta specialize. But I would say as a kid, I was introduced to track and field. I remember we used to run a relay. We used to go to the armory and compete. Mind you, as a kid, you know, growing up in Coney Island, I probably never saw north of Harlem. Like to me, going to the armory was like unfound territory. I remember going to Van Cortlandt Park as a kid and being like, are we in like the land of make-believe or something? Because, you know, Chrysler Park is a gorgeous park. had a beautiful track growing up, but that was all I knew. So going to the Armory for the first time, I was like, what is this? And I remember even being intimidated when we ran our first race there. But yeah, I had a great time. I would say I was encouraged and very much not limited as a kid in terms of my relationship with sports and movement. It was very much like do everything, because at the time, again, my coach was very much like, I want them in front of me where I can see them at all times. So if that means that we got to do multiple things, then we'll do it. Obviously, I excelled at others, you know, other sports more than others. But ultimately, like my favorite ones, I mean, without question, basketball, football, and of course, running.
So your introduction to a variety of different sports, especially in a year-round context, how did that inform how you think about sports now as a professional who works with people who are pursuing all different sorts of goals and endeavors?
What I would probably say, I mean, what I think is, what I know rather, is that your relationship with your body has to be one that is both intentional and intersectional, meaning that if you are a runner and that is your primary sport, you have to be willing to tap into all of the nuanced areas and modalities and movement practices that support you running. Now, that looks different for everybody, right? For some people, strength training might be more so for them at a certain point in their performance or their training programming. Might be resistance training through the lens of like Pilates, right? For whatever reason, maybe they just enjoy it more. For some people, that might be Olympic weightlifting with barbells and doing snatches and lunges and things of that nature. For other people, that might for them be CrossFit. I do not claim as a strength coach to say that, you know, my way is the best way in the universe. I just know that the way I do things has a proven track record for success and it works. But it's not my job to tell someone how they should consider training, because they know their body better than me. What I do know is that as a runner, the primary cause of injury is like overusage. And the best way to combat that or prevent it or to rehab and recover from it, you know, is strength training. And combining that with other things. But when I think about strength training, I think about it holistically, not just, you know, doing barbell curls and, you know, cleans and snatches. But to me, strength training is rooted in the idea of like resiliency. So that includes power development, rate of force development. It includes plyometrics. It includes a level of elasticity, which you would obtain through, you know, body weight exercises at a low impact. So it might be like stretching, right? It might look like yoga, but to me, being able to hold a downward dog, the level of strength that you need is as important as what it would take to do, you know, a box jump or a series of box step ups, if you will. So yeah, I think for me, I've realized very, very early on that I could be very committed to a movement practice, a sport, but the way I prepare for that sport is intersectional, right? The way I ready my body and my mind to be at its best might look different. It might not involve just me doing this one thing. It might involve doing things that don't look like they have a connection to it, but very much are supporting my ability to perform in that sport.
Now, you've been doing this as a professional a long time, like you mentioned. What are some of the things that have changed in the dogma around either lifting or running or the intersection of both over the last 10 or so years that you've seen, that either maybe you've changed within them or just from afar you've seen, like, we used to think this and now we're leaning more towards this? And, you know, not to cast aspersions, but just what are some things that you've seen that have changed over time?
Man, it's so interesting. When I was in high school and when I was in college, ice baths were like everyday practice. It was like normalized. Like, we used to go to like camps and like jump in a pool after a long run or after like a hard workout. And it was cool. All the science said this is a great thing to do. I remember, I think it was like 20.
And frankly, it felt freaking great afterwards. It sucks right during it, but right, it would feel great afterwards. I used amazing to do the same thing. That's why I'm saying.
Yeah, it felt amazing. I want to say around 2016, 2017. No, maybe earlier. Maybe it's like 2014, 2015. Ice baths, terrible. Ice doesn't do anything to inhibit swelling and inflammation. Ice impacts protein muscle synthesis and lactate. It doesn't do anything. And it was like, oh. Everyone stopped doing ice baths. And then now I look up got meta-analysis. Every time I look up, someone's talking about getting out of a cold tub and yada yada, plunges in the Arctic Ocean and Antarctica on the side of a mountain. It's just like, I thought that wasn't... last time I checked, y'all all said we should stop doing this. But I think what I've learned is that we live in a space that is very much driven by capital and commerce. And oftentimes, you know, when something seems to be trending, it's because there's a level of investment by stakeholders. There's a level of product attached to it. There's a level of conversion that's the outcome of it. And I think as a coach, my main focus for my athletes is to cut through the nonsense in terms of like I remember, you know, you know what I'm about to say, but remember that time when like everyone thought if I go get a parachute and I strap it to my back and I do some sprints, like I will get faster. Like,
when I was in high school, I literally, right, my senior year, for 3 months before basketball season, every day of the school year, so 5 days a week for 2 months before the bell season started, I had a weight belt and a rope and a tire. I would be doing track. I'd be doing sprints across the football field every single morning at 6 a.m. Let me tell you, it didn't work. I got no better at basketball. I think it might have been the best placebo ever because I felt like I was improving, but I don't think it actually helped. But no, I keep going.
Right, exactly. To that point, right? I think people oftentimes don't recognize that these objects that are being displayed to us, that are engaged, we're being asked or told to engage with, are merely tools. And these tools are to achieve an adaptation. But the goal is not to A, be a tool, and or be a consumer of tools. The goal is to achieve an adaptation, a change, a result, a desired outcome that is my performance, right? Improved performance. And I think oftentimes, again, my job as a coach is to kind of like know the science, but have the language to be able, and the understanding of the person I'm talking to, and have the language to communicate with them in a way that they understand that makes sense, so that we don't get caught up in the optics in or the perceived outcome that we're hoping to achieve, but rather understanding like the specific steps that we need to take in order to receive a specific adaptation in a very calculated and intentional way. And I think our industry is very much, you know, like here's another good example. There was a time where everyone was putting, they do it now, but there was a moment where everyone was putting carbon fiber plates in their shoes. This is just like one person did it, one brand did it, and now everyone, just put it in the shoe, put it in the shoe. This is the shoe you need to make you faster. And I was laughing because in my mind, I'm like, you know, Ted Corbett, Marilyn Bevins, Kipchoge, the list goes on and on, but, well, not Kipchoge, but... I would say that like when I think about the history of running, when I think about like Fred LeBeau, when I think about people who are staples in the running community, they were running in Converses, right? And they were achieving times that were outstanding. So when I think about that in the context of like technology, it's not to say that running in carbon fiber plates don't have an impact on performance. It is to say that they are not the supplement for performance. They are not the objective in your performance. Your objective is to train and commit to that craft and to that practice. And I oftentimes, again, I'm just very, very aware that, you know, supplementing tools, supplementing hard work and a commitment to your craft and to your training is not a substantial or even credible approach to getting results because you can't substitute for hard work and not even hard work, working smart. And I'm not one that's going to sit here and say, hey, I don't have a pair of those $300 shoes in my living room or in my closet, but I'll be the first person to tell you that those shoes are only going to support me. I mean, I know you say like 4%, 3%, 2%, but I promise you, like, I'm not relying on them shoes to get the job done on race day, you know?
All right, everybody, I want to take a quick break and give a shout out to Lagoon. That's right, Lagoon Sleep. You heard me in the intro talking about their pillows. Oh my gosh, they are amazing. This year, really trying to take better care of myself, both before and after my runs. And one of the areas that I'm really focusing on is sleep. And not just about the time you spend in bed, obviously that's important, but also making sure you have quality and not just quantity. And that's a big thing, right? We talk about all the time with training, quantity and quality. Same thing with sleep. And part of that is your pillow. I have the Fox pillow. That was the one that I got after taking the online quiz, which was really interesting to take. You figure out, like, what exactly do I need? What do I need my pillow for? How do I sleep? What are my preferences? And it makes a big difference. And this is a pillow I've had for over a month now. It's coincided with my biggest 30 days of training that I've ever had. And I feel really, really good. And I know a big reason for that is because of how I'm sleeping, and how I'm sleeping is affected by my pillow, and things are just going so well for me. Waking up from my morning runs has never felt better. I'm refreshed. I'm pain-free, in large part thanks to Lagoon Pillow. So go to lagoonsleep.com. That's L-A-G-O-O-N sleep.com/rambling. Take their awesome 2-minute sleep quiz to find your match, and then use code rambling for 15% off your first purchase today. Right. I love that. You know, obviously these shoes are great shoes, but at the same time, like you said, they don't alter their trajectory for most people, which is the same reason we talk. I know you talk to masters athletes all the time, as do I. I am a masters athlete, in fact, and I coach a bunch of them, where you're like, you know, if you're thinking about like the best runners in the world, yes, they will probably be slower in their 40s than their 30s, because their arc of their career also matches their physical potential, because they have maxed out their physical potential, right? Like,
right.
I can't speak for you. I certainly did not maximize my physical potential in my 30s. So I can be better in my 40s than my 30s, even if like my tangible ceiling as an athlete may be lower. Maybe it's like the 38th floor of a building instead of the 40th floor of a building. I'm only on the 16th floor right now, so I got plenty of room to get better. You know, to your point, like I just looked up a random time. I just typed into my phone as you were talking. You probably saw me doing it. 1978 Boston Marathon winning time, right? Just a random year, long time ago, prior to any shoe tech, right? It was Bill Rogers who ended up winning it. He ran 2:10. If an American man, everyone's 2:10 Boston, even this year, it's gonna be like, that's a great time. Congratulations to whoever did it. This dude was basically wearing like, you know, 4 millimeters of rubber underneath his feet, and he had a full-time job at the same time. So again, this, you bring up a good point. Like, you can do all the tips and tricks, and I know you get hit up with marketing emails every day from companies, with plenty of them, as do I. And you sit there and you're like, I don't think this is gonna be the difference maker in an athlete's journey. But at the same time, let me ask you this question. This begs another piece, right? You know, are well-versed in a lot of the best practices from an athlete perspective. At the same time, individuals also come in with preferences. So how do you dovetail these two things? Of like, here are the best practices that will help this person become, we just mentioned marathon, so a better marathoner over the next 12 months. But at the same time, maybe some of these best practices don't fit with the things that they just personally don't like to do. Maybe they just love doing CrossFit. So you're like, okay, maybe CrossFit isn't like the ideal modality for a marathoner, but they also love it. So how do you marry these two interests where maybe sometimes they're not perfectly aligned?
Yeah, language. I think I've gotten really good at being a communicator. I would say that for a number of people, what I attempt to do is like meet them where they are. So if you come to me and you tell me that CrossFit is what you want to do, and that's like your preferred modality of training or cross training rather for your marathon training. Cool. When we get in the gym, we will do movements. I'm really good at my job as a strength coach. I know how to achieve an adaptation in a way that's going to support you as a runner and creatively make you think that this is what CrossFit is. I think the interesting thing about CrossFit is that this is just great marketing, because the first time I ever took a CrossFit class, I was like, this is Olympic weightlifting compiled with conditioning. That's what we're doing. Like,
right. It's Olympic lifts for time.
Right. Like that's exactly what this is. Like, I said, okay, so how many snatches can you do in 5 minutes? Oh, okay. Burpees. How many? Oh, so Olympic weightlifting plus conditioning. You marketed it at this thing, and that's great. And I hope we make you, not we, because I'm not getting it down, but I hope y'all make as much money as possible. But I recognize that, like, that's more so rooted in storytelling and marketing and not an actual real tangible modality. So for me, it's also knowing that and narrating around that and telling them and letting them know, like, hey, you like CrossFit. It may be in part because the stimulus that you're getting from doing it, right, the lack of rest time in conjunction with the high intensity effort that you're putting forth might make you feel like you're running, right? Your energy system that you might be tapping into, you might think that these things are like the same and you like a good burn. And that's what you're getting from this moment. Cool. Let's simulate that burn, but let's just identify it and look at it a little bit differently. I'm going to make you burn when you're on the track. When the speed workout that we work, when it's just this tempo run that we're going to do, I'm going to make you burn when we are doing your strength training in terms of how you understand or how you move throughout like a rear foot elevated split squat or doing like an overcoming isometric or a yielding isometric. When you do these things, the adaptation that you're going to achieve is different, but the stimulus, the impact of that adaptation, the feeling that your nervous system is going to get might very well feel like, whoo, I'm sweating. Wow, that was rough. And I think for me as a coach, it's having the knowledge, obviously, of these different practices and these different like areas and skill sets, but also the language to really speak to them in a way that makes sense for the person who is an enthusiast and has got great work ethic or really passionate about a thing. But it's not my job to sit here and say, no, don't do that, right? Because unless you're talking to me about, you know, wanting to jump off a bridge or why you're going to drink every day during your training or why you love to just smoke all the time, unless it's like an obvious red flag, I can figure out a way to help you figure it out. It's just a matter of like your willingness to commit to our approach to doing it and not wanting to just lean on your own understanding. Because if that's the case, then like, why am I here to begin with? You hired me to be a coach, not the person that just tells you yes all the time.
Let me ask you a question that relates to that last part that you just mentioned.
Shoot.
In terms of like the coaching pie, how much of it is your expertise and your ability to communicate that expertise to your client? And how much of it is like basically like an unlicensed therapist talking with your client about the different things that are going on in their life and the ways that they can, you know, whether it's self-sabotage or the endless list of things that can be influencing their ability to perform in whatever activity, but namely, especially in your area, on the athletic side?
Ah, man, that's a good one. I think it depends on the person. This I've had the honor and privilege to work with some really amazing athletes. And I would say all of them did not need me to kind of like hold their hand in terms of being like a support system. There's some folks who were very much checked the boxes, but locked in, and they showed up ready to just get coached. And I would say they were the easiest ones to work with. Just because to that point, I didn't have to put on or wear this hat of being a therapist and a hand holder and a very much a nurturer. I think as a coach, I inherently understand that is part of my job that I personally like embrace. But I recognize that there are moments where that does impact someone's ability to train. And it's not unfortunate. It's not fortunate. It's just the reality of the situation. But I do think it's very much on an individual basis. I think I've met some folks who, you know, ran great times and life was in shambles, but like they were committed to training. I met folks who training was conversation. They wanted to yap and yap and yap. And like, they were okay. They just wanted somebody to talk to. They really did. Like, I thought they wanted a coach when they first came to me. I very quickly realized, oh no, you just wanted somebody to talk to. And then I've had people who, you know, were just on one side of either spectrum. Ultimately though, I don't really care. I think my job is to make sure that you are getting the most out of this experience and to put my ego and attachment to what I think you signed up for aside. Like, we can have all the feeler conversations and the needs analysis and the dialogue around, you know, your training program and like, you know, discipline and commitment level. And you can pay me, you know, the rate and all the things. Once we get, you know, 6, 8 weeks, 5 weeks, 2 weeks into a program, I know you now and you know me. And yeah, it's just about locking in and getting not just on the other side of that goal, but giving you some valuable experiences and learnings along the way so that before and after this race is done, you feel like not only did you reach your goal, but you feel invincible and you feel seen as a person.
All right, I'm going to give you a chance to do like a little like BuzzFeed, like top tips article kind of thing. All right.
Okay, gotcha.
All right, so if you're talking to somebody, all right, let's do this. Let me phrase it this way. What are things that people don't quite understand about what it means or what it takes to become the best runner that they can possibly be? What are some common misconceptions that people think, hey, I want to do what it takes and I have a pretty good understanding what that means, but maybe people don't quite understand just exactly what that sort of investment entails?
Time. I think oftentimes when I encounter people like that, they don't recognize the amount of time and sacrifice that it takes to develop the aerobic energy system. I think, you know, I remember there was outreach from someone, they were like a coach, like a trainer, and they wanted to train for a marathon. And they reached out, email back and forth, talking the phone, cool, we get in the gym, we're talking. And in their mind, you know, the idea of running, you know, 40 miles a week is like, when am I gonna do that? And in my mind, I'm saying to myself, did you not think that you would have to eventually get to a point where you are running based off the time goal that you have and given like where you're currently existing at on your own with your just lifestyle training, that was like not going to be a requirement. And they were just like, I just never knew I had to run so much. And I think for them and for a number of people, it's less about the time I spend running and more so about the time I have to sacrifice preparing to run. So for example, you know, if you know, your 16-week, 12-week program, you're getting ready for the New York City Marathon, that means you're training over the summer. That means on Friday nights, and especially if you're in New York City, if you live here, when everyone's out and kicking it, having a great time and, you know, staying up late and drinking, you probably should be going to some sleep. Because you probably are going to wake up really early in the morning before it gets really hot, nasty outside and go for a run. And if you don't do that, understand that you're going to be running in like extreme heat. And that also is going to put a lot of stress on your nervous system and impact your training. Simultaneously, if you run at night, you're missing out on what you might want to have done. So you got to really be strategic and intentional about your commitment to training and the time and the sacrifices that you're willing to make. That means during wedding season and travel season, and hey, I got a bar mitzvah, I got an anniversary, I got this, I got that, I got this conference I got to go to. I'm not saying don't go. I'm asking you, have you outlined when you booked that ticket and when you scheduled that flight and that booked that hotel room, did you simultaneously go on Strava and map out a route for yourself? Did you think about like when I land, this is what I'm going from here to here. I'm getting dressed. I'm going to eat. I'm going to stay hydrated. I'm going to get off the plane, unpack my bag. I'm traveling in my gear, and then I'm taking off my sweatsuit. I'm getting right out there on the trail. Like, what's your level of commitment to this actual craft and this practice? Because I'm not saying that everyone needs to have that level of commitment. I am saying that everyone needs to have an understanding of the amount of time that is required when you are committed to training. Because it's going to pull you away from things. And not because, oh, like you got to be dedicated in anything rooted in grind culture. Your aerobic energy system is the most difficult to develop and simultaneously the most elusive, meaning it is the first one to go because the source of energy is oxygen. It's not like your other energy systems where if I could lift, you know, a dumbbell, I could do a dumbbell curl and I can curl a dumbbell that's 30 pounds 10 times. And then I don't step foot in the gym, you know, for 3 months or 6 months. When I come back, I grab that same dumbbell and I could probably still get it 8 times or 9 times. Maybe I can get it still 10. My body, because of that energy system, that makes sense. And running, when you stop and you decide, hey, I'm going to decrease my overall volume. I'm going to decrease for an extended period of time, even as up to 2.5-3 weeks. The returns that you will get are, or the drop off that you'll see in your performance are drastic. And I think not enough people understand that because the language and the way we understand running and how it's been coached relative to how we coach traditional other performance sports that are a different energy system hasn't been like done in a way that's palatable or accessible. So for me, I think it's very much rooted in science as to the why, but I think in a practical sense in conversation, it hasn't been narrated or articulated in a way that a lot of people understand. So for me, I think the most common issue is time and sacrifice.
Now, you really sketched that out nicely in terms of like a day-to-day, week-to-week time commitment, what it takes, the planning that are set associated with that time commitment. Talk to me about just like the long tail as well, just in terms of growth potential over months and years, and how you talk about that time horizon in relation to stretch goals, right? Someone comes to you like, hey, I'm a 4:30 marathoner, right? Which is pretty close to the average for, you know, most marathons and just the general population. So a lot of people listening to this are probably around 4:30 marathoners, right? This is a dedicated amateur running podcast. That person comes to you and says, hey, I want to get down to 3:15, right? So it's maybe it's athletically possible for that individual. It's not something that like that, you can't do that. We can't, you know, this is, you know, we need to reshift the goal here. And this is just an example that you don't have to run with, but just talk about the time horizon here when it comes to stretch goals.
Yeah, I think there's an old saying that goes, sprinters are born and runners are made. I always like to tell people like you're in the sport of marathoning, which means like it takes time. And you got to be really, really comfortable and confident in your ability to be present and simultaneously, I would say, present and then committed to time. Because ultimately, you can decrease your time. You can, hypothetically speaking, drop, you know, what was that? I don't know, over an hour, right? That you just mentioned, like, yeah. that can happen. However, what time constraint are we speaking of? Because to improve as a runner, it takes changes at the cellular and molecular level of your human, right? Your body is, your lungs, the tissue there is literally different than what it was when you ran at another point in time. That takes not only a lot of time to happen, it also simultaneously impacts the other energy systems and tissue in your body. That being said, it's not so much about, okay, this is going to take a long time. It's how is my body going to respond to this stimulus and this commitment that I've made? Because we don't know, like running 4:30, great, that's your starting point. But as you prepare and train for, let's say, 4:15, how does your body respond to that? Right, progressive overload comes into play, meaning the ability to program intentionally over time that we are increasing your volume and your approach to volume progressively, and not just like throwing a house at you all at once. That takes a toll on your body. It is inherently hard and difficult, and it's more of an art than it is rooted in science. It's like a dance. So if I step left and you sprain your ankle, that doesn't mean that we don't step left. Like injury is a part of, unfortunately, it's not to say that you're gonna get injured. It is to say that like injury happens. It's the reason why you hire strength coaches, et cetera, physical therapists, et cetera. But recognizing that the objective is to reach a goal and simultaneously learn and take notes and take details away as we progress to then figure out what our best practices are from A to B. But then recognize that to get from B to C, it's going to take learnings from A to B and then a new approach of refiguring out, because you're literally a new human at that point. And that is just something that is always and ever going to be a constant in this sport. And I think the more we can normalize those kind of conversations and that approach, it becomes more practical and tangible for people instead of the traditional, like, the mindset of like a before and after picture. It's like, well, I lost 20 pounds and I got 12 pack abs. I can run really fast. It's like, if only you knew that you losing 12 pounds and having a 12 pack contributes to your conditioning, and it certainly contributes to your aesthetic. I don't know if that's going to get you, I just don't know if it's going to get you to drop like over an hour in your marathon time within like 6 months. That's a right. lot of work. And even if you did, is that sustainable and is that healthy? Are you actually okay? So I think from that perspective, it's really important to really sit with not just the fact that from a just a science perspective that it is difficult, but also just recognizing that and committing to that journey and that commitment to training, that you have to be able and willing to check in with your body and understand how it's being experienced in a moment, and then shifting your game plan and your mindset as you go, and not saying, I'm going to do this and this is how it's going to get done. It just doesn't work that way.
Hey, folks, let's talk about vacation races. So vacation races host half marathons, ultra marathons, and trail running festivals at national parks around the country and week-long running adventures all around the world. These global adventures offer daily 7 to 12K trail runs in the morning and afternoon activities that include high adventure things like glacier treks, zip lining, whitewater rafting, or cultural activities like wine tasting, falconry, historic tours, cooking classes. These things, they offer just such a wide range of things. If you're worried about pace, don't be. They require runners to maintain around a 20-minute mile pace. So as long as you're basically moving with purpose, you're going to be just fine. These adventures are all-inclusive, which means hotels, in-country transportation, meals, drinks, activities, and swag are all covered in the trip, and they just announced their full 2024 calendar, which you're going to want to check out. Again, I know we just started 2023, but you got to plan these trips way in advance, and that's exactly what they're trying to do. They have 11 different destinations. Examples are like Alaska, Costa Rica, Croatia, Ecuador, Iceland, Ireland, Japan, New Zealand, Patagonia. So many. It really is remarkable. You can go check them out at vacationraces.com. New customers can use Rambling 200 for $200 off any global adventure trip that is not currently sold out. Also, you can use code Rambling15 for 15% off any of the half marathons or ultra marathon adventures that are not currently sold out. So remember, it's code Rambling200 for the global adventures and Rambling15 for 15% off the half marathon or ultra marathons. So you are in a unique situation now where you work with Nike as a running coach. You helped Winston Duke prepare for his role in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. So you're someone who has worked with some very high profile people. You have high profile jobs and you live in a very high profile area. With that said, you most certainly have people who come to you who maybe look at others, whether they're specific people like, I want to look like Winston Duke, or they maybe right. speak a little bit more generally in terms of like looking at external people or goals and then saying, I want to do that, or I want to be them. So how do you approach these external goals or influences with your clients? And how do you then approach the more internalized and internal side of things? I know this is a very general question, but I know you've approached this topic in a lot of different forms.
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally not a fan of before and after pictures. I do think that they have their place in terms of being able to narrate around, you know, especially if you're like a business owner, you're a trainer, you want to use them as opportunities to drive awareness to your services and show that you can, you know, support people in getting results. I think that's a valid approach. It has proven to work. I don't do it because the undertone or the underlining message I feel like is that it's essentially saying that someone's value as a human is predicated off of their appearance, that your impact on society and your character can be defined by images. And I don't believe that to be true. I do believe that as a person, you are inherently worthy of respect and joy, experiencing joy, but simultaneously you're worthy of like dignity and care and love. And you should be celebrated and you should be welcomed in spaces, not because like you didn't have abs and now you have them, or not because your butt was big then and it wasn't before it and is now. So I say that to say that I recognize that there are people out there who are very much committed and driven by at moments or definitely by aesthetics. I think the conversation for me is really rooted in their health and how they feel about themselves. So, you know, when someone comes to me and says, hey, so I want to lose 20 pounds. I want abs. I want my butt big. I want my arms to be chiseled. I'm like, well, how do you feel about your butt? I think it's small. Okay. How do you feel about your abs? How do you feel about your body? How do you feel about yourself as a whole? I don't like myself. Well, and that's really the point that I want to like unpack and really have a more, not, you know, really in detailed critical therapist conversation around, but more so getting you to first name and then getting you to understand, not getting you, getting collective buy-in from both parties to recognize that it is important to change my appearance, but my appearance is a reflection or really speaking to how I feel about myself. And that is something that I deserve, or rather I acknowledge that you deserve to feel better about, right? So it's less to do with like, oh, let's, you know, shame people for posting before and after pictures. Let's not do that. Because again, they do have a place. And I also think that it is okay to have aesthetic goals. It's okay to say, hey, I want my chest to be more defined, and I want my shoulders and my traps to be bigger. I just recognize that what I don't want to do is conflict that with your value as a person. So when people come to me and ask or tell me that, hey, I want to do this because I want to lose weight and I want to, you know, change my body composition in some capacity, great. Why? Right? How do you feel about yourself? That is, what is that connected to that makes you want to make this change? And typically that conversation is very much a space of learning or unlearning for both parties. However, I still think it's a positive conversation. And just, you know, a step in the process of them getting to trust me, me getting to understand them and trust them more, and then us being able to work together.
Do you feel like these conversations where you're basically asking someone to be vulnerable with you have become easier or more accepted, especially for people, especially for, say, with men coming from a more masculine background, say they're raised in a very masculine household? Do you think things have changed in terms of being able to open up in this way, especially with someone who is inherently basically a stranger that you are to some of these people, especially early on in the process?
I could see how someone might feel a bit uncomfortable, but I think, you know, the storyteller, the community focused person that I am, it's just my job to make you feel comfortable and feel welcome. I think it's my job as the practitioner to create an environment for you to feel brave enough to be vulnerable and comfortable enough to have that conversation with me. I recognize that for some people that boundary and that level of connection to dialogue might be different in terms of like their comfort level and willingness to have it. But I also recognize that it's up to me to first create an environment for that to be cultivated, right? And then simultaneously, just inviting them to it and welcoming them to it and recognizing that and naming that this is a safe space and a brave space for them. I haven't gotten pushback thus far, but it's not to say that it's not out there. It's not to say that everyone agrees with me. It's not to say that everyone is opening up to me. But I do think that when people commit and we're seeing each other, you know, week after week, day after day, eventually there is going to be a moment where we have a level of understanding and we connect in terms of understanding like your why about why you're here. And, you know, again, that's where, you know, my job as a coach is just it's important to understand and to recognize. But you know, taking it back to what you mentioned about like Black Panther 2, homie had aesthetic goals. He was like, man, I'm gonna look great.
Yeah. And it's about to be on a movie, right? I would want
right,
to be too.
Right, right. Yeah, I get it. Like, I get it. It makes sense to me. So it's like, you know, just being able to navigate that and in a professional way, but also in an intentional way. Because, you know, people are trusting you with their heart and you do not at any point in time, you know, want to make them feel uncomfortable. And or create a space where, you know, you're not a trustworthy individual.
And do you think it's basically, when it comes down to it, inherent in that kind of exploration, whether it's completely internal or whether you, you know, vocalize it to another person in order to reach long-term goals? Because it seems like the motivation and external forces can be useful in the short term. But I oftentimes compare it to like trying to like light a bonfire, like to keep a bonfire going with like starter fluid, like lighter fluid. It's like, it's just not going to work. It's not a sustainable fuel source for the long term. Like it might help you in spurts, but you need something else. There needs to be something more there if you're really going to go for it for the long term. Again, that's just a hypothesis on my end. You know, I'd love to hear kind of your reaction to that.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it kind of depends. I feel like I've met so many people, had so many experiences on the spectrum in terms of coaching that, yeah, I think you can simultaneously show up in a space and, you know, be in the short term driven by an external like force or factor. And then along the way, the discipline kicks in and it maintains. But, you know, life be lifing, as we say, and things happen. I don't know that short term moments of lighter fluid aren't a good thing, right? Because shit, even as a coach, like you might be locked in and you might be the most disciplined person ever. But then it might be that one little thing that you just off on a day and I got to find it. And I found it and I'm going to say it. And I'm like,
anything to get out the door kind of feeling.
Yeah. It's like sometimes, you know, it is as long as this is like a safe and brave space where people don't feel like they're being, you know, it's not predatory, it's not condescending, it's not toxic, it's not, you're not talking down on people. Like, it's okay to lean in and really be intentional in your language and your verbiage and your tone about, you know, how you are motivated or what motivates you. I think just recognizing like the timing of that, right, is really, really important. But I do think that, you know, short-term things, you know, they always, but they are relevant and can be tapped into at any point in the journey. I remember, you know, my first marathon, man, like I'm out there, I'm sneaking to the front because the homies is up front. We all got on our singlets. I'm like been training with the team. I'm ready to go. And as I'm going up there, I saw somebody who I was already locked in that day. I was ready to go. I mean, I was running on a broken foot, but like I did not care. I was finna run my first marathon. I was gonna break four. I was doing all the things. Like it was a thing, right? And I remember already, you know, was on a 10 and I'm walking up to the start. I'm, you know, get through New York City, you dodging people. I'm using these broad shoulders. I'm knocking folks out the way. And like, I saw this person and I ain't like him. I ain't never like him. We ain't never gonna be friends. We not friends. And man, I promise you, it made a difference. I raced them that entire 26.2 miles. I beat them. I made sure when I passed them, I threw them a peace sign. Like it gave me a little something that I didn't know I needed. And that's not a bad thing, you know? Like, cause for me anyway, you know, people talk about all the journeying and running and that the language around the journey and being willing to lean into it is great. There's some people out there, man, who want to compete. There are people out there who want to get after it. There's people out there, excuse my language, who want to bust my ass and fuck something up. And I personally believe that that's okay in a concentrated environment, in a specific context, right? That's okay and not in terms of harming the person, but, you know, now I got a little extra to push in the moment where I maybe didn't know I needed it, or maybe I did need it. And that's just an example or a story for me, but I do think that it's okay to have, you know, to find, if you will, or to have a little package of lighter fluid on top of just having, you know, some good matches, some good wood, and some good weather.
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. I feed off that.
Right.
So in a competitive situation, I definitely feed off the hate, and there are certainly times where, like, I need to drum it up in order to get out the door. Like, make no mistake about it. But I also know that, like, I think Lance Armstrong and Michael Jordan are the only people who can literally fuel an entire career off hate. I think some people need to have a little bit a little bit more centeredness, especially if you're, you know, I don't know, who knows. But I think having your feet planted in both worlds is probably a pretty healthy spot to be.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, sometimes you just lean a little further to the left, lean a little further to the right, you know, whatever works. I'm a fan of whatever's going to work, whatever you feel like you need to do to navigate, you know, check in with yourself during a given moment, go ahead and make it happen. And as your coach, I'm never going to shy away from that for you. So if it's like, I had a client one day, man, we were going out and they were like, man, my girlfriend just broke up with me. I was like, damn. And they were like, I'm about to run. And I was like, yeah. It's like, you know, and then I had clients who were like, yeah, my girlfriend just broke up with me. And I'm like, how you feeling? They were like, I think I'm gonna take a day off. And I was like, cool. You know, I think I'm the coach who listens first. And based upon what I'm hearing, I'll let my understanding of you and my discernment kind of guide that conversation. But yeah, man, it's a real thing. It's a real thing. I'm not the person that, I'm not the person that you want to talk about. Like, don't make me think of you in this kind of setting. Cause I promise I'm a very self-motivated person, but man, when you intentionally go out of your way to like make me the person who already has the ability to like create a narrative and a story in their mind about somebody, whether it's true or not, I'm good at it. Like I was watching that that doc on Michael Jordan.
Of course.
It was like that guy, the Last Dance. I forget the dude's name, but he was some random guy who was just an NBA player on an average team who nobody ever heard of. And he had a decent night against Mike. And, you know, not like anything crazy, just decent. Like I would think it was like 18 or something like that. It wasn't like he went off crazy. He had a standard NBA game against, you know, the greatest player ever. But I never forget, they talked about that story about how Mike like tormented that man and made up this whole narrative in the media about like how this guy was like a thing. And I was like, I do that all the time. I do it. I do it like regularly. I will identify something for a moment and then create a narrative around it simply for the sake of like executing something and then move on from it like it never happened.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. And I think there is definitely a place for that. There's no question about it. There's so many people who you can use that. And I tell people all the time, like whatever it takes to get you out the door, use it. As long as it's not hurting anybody, use it. Right. I think a great example of this, too, like everyone loves the Michael Jordan stories and Lord knows his best former college basketball player. I love him just as much as everybody else. But I remember there's one that I heard that was great. It was Dave Scott. So one of like basically like the first guy on like the triathlon, you know, Hall of Fame, right? The first guy for Ironman. He had, as a high school swimmer, I've read this whole book about Dave Scott. So a high school swimmer, or even before that, he was like a young teenager. He got beat at this meet by some kid from the Midwest named Murphy Reinschreiber was his name. I remember this name. So it was like 15 years later, Dave Scott's the best triathlete in the world. He is at Ironman or some race, some like high level race. And then that guy, Murphy Reinschreiber, again, 15 years later, just like an amateur athlete, just kind of shows up at the same event. He's just there to like, he's a weekend warrior, just trying to get the most out of his life. When Dave Scott sees him at the starting line. Again, Dave Scott, the most famous man in triathlon, goes up to this guy, puts his finger in his chest, and he's like, I remember you from the California State Fair 15 years ago, and I'm here today for payback. It's like, this would be like Michael Jordan going up to you in a men's league, being like, I'm bringing it to you tonight, Purcell. You'd be like, what the hell did I do? I'm just standing here. So yeah. I love these kind of stories. They if for no other reason than they're extremely entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. I have lined up to run the midnight half before. This is like 2017, something like that. And I saw this dude who was like my then ex-girlfriend's friend, who was a little too close for comfort back when she was my girlfriend. And he was in
sounds
the race.
Sounds like a Biz Markie song.
Right. I was like, oh, I'm finna kill you today. Like, you don't understand that. Me and you are now personally racing. And I'm just gonna make sure that you see
He has no idea. You're like, I'm racing you.
I promise you had no clue. Like, didn't even know I was there. Promise, you didn't know. Didn't know. They might not have even been dating at the time. Like, didn't matter. Didn't matter. Matter of fact, I got a lot of these stories, man. I could go on for days about me. The P in my name doesn't stand for Purcell. It stands for Petty first, Purcell second. But
I love it. No, so thank you so much for sharing all this. There's so much more I want to talk about. I got to pick up my kids at school, so I literally have to cut this interview short. And you stayed longer than you even said you would. So thank you so much for doing this, Purcell. I really appreciate it. Before we get going, though, we do have to say, if people want to learn more about you and all the things that you are doing, not only for your clients, but for the running and sporting world in general, where can they go?
Yeah, check me out on Instagram. Good Work is my tag, GOODWRK. Like I said, Nike running coach, strength coach, really passionate about, you know, community health. Obviously I'm a storyteller, I'm a marketer. Check me out on Instagram. Check me out on my website, Good Work, GOOD-WRK.com. I'm on TikTok, Good Work P, spelled the same way, GOODWRKP. I'm around, I'm outside. I'm not one of these folks who like, a blue check verified and got a lot of followers and you never seen him out a day in your life, I'm very much an accessible dude, person. So like, you know, holler at me, I'm around. And yeah, I look forward to hopefully engaging with everyone else in the near future. I have some really cool stuff coming out on the Nike Run Club app, some guided runs that I'm really excited about folks being able to engage with and participate in. So yeah, I'm around, I'm outside. If you ever see me in the street, just say, hey, Coach P, I promise I won't look at you crazy.
I love it. And go follow him on Instagram. The guy has almost 150,000 followers. We got to put him over the top. 146K. Help Coach P get to 150K.
Hey, help me get to 200. That'd be great.
There you go. I love it. Big goals. Thank you so much for coming on.
Not a problem, Matt. Have a good one.